Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening. Zen practice is not yet fully understood in this country. Well, it hasn't been here that long, and it takes a while, but there's still some misunderstandings of what the practice is and what it does and what it should do. There's various ideas. Some people believe that Zen is some kind of mystical practice, that we will have some mystical experience with the practice, and that the practice will reveal to us the unknown or the unknowable, the mystical, some kind of other world. That the practice will provide us insight into this other world that we believe is there, that we hunger to see and to know. But our practice is not about seeing into another world. Nothing mysterious about our practice. If you look carefully at the practice, after you have been engaged in it for a while, from your own experience, you will see that our practice is quite unmystical, quite straightforward. Our practice is about developing an uncluttered mind and an unbiased view of life. Uncluttered mind, beginner's mind, as has been made famous by the title of Suzuki Roshi's book. Our practice is to develop, to cultivate an uncluttered mind free of delusion. And through the practice, as we sit quietly and allow our mind to become free, we develop discipline and generosity, confidence, by simply keeping our awareness on the present moment of our life, on the cushion or elsewhere. Through our awareness and the discipline and confidence that expands, we feel that our lives, our practice and our lives, can express our true nature, our universal nature, or what is known in Buddhism as Buddha nature, the nature that everything shares, the nature that everything expresses. When we feel that, when we can see that, then we realize that the mystical, the so-called mystical, is indeed the ordinary, that there is no separation, no distinction. So very simply, our practice says that when we put aside our mental clutter and our biases and our attachments, we can express ourself truly, our true self, the self that is very vast, immense, much bigger than our individual personal selves, the self that contains and is itself contained in everything and everyone, everywhere. All of this seems, like a philosophy or some kind of metaphysics, but that's not so. Also, this is not intellectual. It's not some explanation. There is no explanation. Only your practice will clarify your true self. So when the meaning of our life, when we are confused about the meaning of our life, when the meaning of what we're doing with this life and the meaning of our life is not clear, it means we are attached to, we are addicted to our conditioned self, our conceptual self, a fictional idea about ourself. This is the point of Buddhism. This is the point of practice, which says we have to go beyond some made-up idea about ourself, about who we are. Until we can go beyond that, we're not free. When we are addicted to some idea about ourself, we will always become attracted to or attached, become attached to things that seem attractive, but are simply temporary expression of our true nature. And it is this attachment that we carry around in our everyday life that is the cause of much confusion and much anxiety. Because it causes us to hold on to misleading ideas about our life. So, we practice not to gain access to some mystical world. We practice to express our true self. And at the same time, our practice includes a study of ourself, which means we stay engaged, we notice, we pay attention, so that we can let go or set aside the misleading ideas that we become aware of. Then the activities of our life can express our true self. And we find a calm and settled feeling. The mind of equanimity. Mind of equanimity is, it's good. It's good for us. And it's good for the people we meet and the people we know and the people we have relationships with. So in one of our chants, we say, I will save all sentient beings. There's a lot of sentient beings. So that's a big vow. And its meaning can be found in our practice. It comes out of our practice. It is our vow. I vow to save everyone, anyone. Without judgment. It's a promise we make to ourselves and others. It is a promise to live authentically without adding anything, without seeking anything. Just to live in the most straightforward way that we can, without clutter. So sometimes, maybe much of the time, we are touched or we are moved by the suffering of others, and we want to reach out and help in whatever way we can. But if we are not mindful of ourselves, even though we have a feeling of empathy or compassion, if we are not mindful of ourselves, our effort may be greedy, in fact. We may be wanting to reach out and help more for ourselves than for the other. It's a trap. It can be a trap if we are not mindful of our motivation. We may be, in fact, secretly trying to fill our own desire or fill our own need. We have to be careful of not wanting to proclaim, "Look at me, I'm helping. Look at me, I am compassionate." This can be a trap unless we pay attention to ourselves. This is why we say to study Buddhism is to study the self. So we have to be actively engaged in the process of our practice, and not believe that sitting on the cushion is enough, that it is some kind of magic. We have to be actively engaged. I remember the first volunteer work that I did many years ago. I was so full of pride. I told my friends. I did come to realize what I was doing, and I did feel ashamed, and I realized, so there's that in me. My giving is not 100% pure. When we discover that feeling in ourselves, we may be a little bit embarrassed, a little bit ashamed, but it's a good thing because we discovered it. And now we can do something about it and not walk around in delusion about how we feel about such things. So we may be successful in solving a problem or helping somebody or relieving a difficulty. We may be truly helpful, and people say, "Thank you, I'm so grateful to you." But if our effort comes from misunderstanding of what we're doing and who we are, it will develop into pride. And through this pride, we create a monument to ourselves. and create more problems. In the world of humans, wherever you go on this planet where there are humans, some of them, some people think they are closer to God than others. My religion is better than yours. You don't see things my way, so you're an infidel, sort of thing. Some people think they are closer to God than others. And this is a huge misunderstanding of the nature of things. It is a very narrow view of the world, what we refer to in Buddhism as small mind. It is the small mind that creates monuments to itself. Monuments are a burden. The monuments we create about ourselves are a burden. When we create them, they're clean, shiny, and bright, and we admire them. But like all monuments, they become ugly. They tarnish, they lose their bright color, and they become covered with droppings. They become tarnished and faded. We recently received a gift of a new Buddha statue, and it's in the backyard, and there's some people are having a discussion about where to put it, where to place it. And one idea is, well, you know, there's the symbol of Buddha sitting under the Buddha Bodhi tree. So why don't we put the statue under the tree? And people said, you know, birds sit in that tree. So we're looking for a place where we can have this statue so it doesn't accumulate droppings. And we need to look at our own life in the same way. Birds don't care about monuments. It's not special. They're not special to the birds. They do not hesitate to drop on them. Birds just go in the tree and do what birds do. They don't say, oh, wait, it's a monument. In the same way, other people don't care about our own personal monuments. Did you ever notice that? People don't care about the monuments that we've created. If we feel that someone doesn't like our monument, we become upset. We might even become angry. And this, of course, is not helpful or saving all beings. But to notice our own reaction when we feel somebody isn't complimenting me on my monument, when we notice that, we notice something important about ourselves and about our practice. And we say, oh, I've just discovered something about myself. I'm going to work on that. So when we do not dismiss these uncomfortable feelings, but simply accept them and say, yeah, that made me uncomfortable, that made me a little upset. No need to be upset. No need to be upset. I have to take care of that. The monuments that people most revere and respect are old, you know, they were created a long time ago. Monuments are things of the past. They look like they will be around forever. But we can't hold on to them. The statues look like they're so solid, they will be here thousands of years. But as we saw some weeks ago, the Notre Dame Cathedral caught fire and was partially destroyed. We can't really hold on to monuments. It's okay to have them, but we have to understand that's not who we really are. They are not who we really are. So we should be mindful about how we do things, how we create things, and what it is that we are creating. And what is the true meaning of creating? And we have to be mindful about how we try to hold on to the things that we create. All of that, all of those observations are part of our practice. So the Buddhist teachings, fundamental Buddhist teaching, tells us that everything in this world comes from emptiness. Like flowers from the garden, or rain from the sky. Everything is emptiness. And at the same time, everything is form. And we recite this on a Saturday morning in our ceremony. When we recite the Heart Sutra, we say, form is emptiness and emptiness is form, both. We say it, we recite it, we chant it, we try to make more accurate translations of it from the Japanese or Chinese or Sanskrit. So we say it, but we can't explain it. Form is emptiness. What? Emptiness is form. Huh? What? Explain. Only when we have the mind of equanimity can we understand the meaning of this chant. Only when we have the mind of equanimity can our life explain what it is that cannot be explained. So from a calm and stable mind of equanimity, we can respond to suffering. We can respond to difficulties that we encounter without the clutter of our own personal desires. This is how we should take care of something in the moment, without ideas of creating a monument to ourselves, without messy droppings left over. Then there's nothing that can be tarnished, and we find true creativity. But without equanimity, we are always looking for the opportunity to create a monument to ourselves. In one of Suzuki Roshi's lectures, contained in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, a chapter about the railroad track. And he said, he says the Bodhisattva's way is the railroad track. And he goes on to say, there's no such thing as the railroad track. Your sincerity is the railroad track. So through our quiet practice, we can observe our emotional tendencies, one of them being feeling the need to create a monument to ourselves. But when we see this tendency and other tendencies and their effects on ourselves and on others, it makes us feel troubled. And we will say to ourselves, this is ridiculous. I don't want to live my life this way. I have to put an end to this. This is the vow to save all beings. This is the feeling of sincerity. So through the troubled feeling that we have when we notice that we are off balance, we will discover the motivation to vow to continue our practice, to not get caught by a desire for monuments. Practice means create monuments. And don't worry about polishing monuments. Does anyone have a question tonight?
I teach mathematics at De Anza College. I've been teaching for a long time. And occasionally, not very often, but sometimes a student challenges me, my teaching, in some way I perceive it as a challenge and I get very upset. So have I built a monument to myself as a great teacher? Is that why I get upset?
What do you think?
I'm not sure. I guess I have an opinion. Obviously there's a whole mesh of thoughts about myself as a teacher, you know, like there's pride there and I want to be respected. There's a lot of stuff going on about it. I mean, I think that's true with everybody, and if they have a job or something they're good at, and if someone attacks it, you feel it's upsetting. I mean, I don't know anybody who... You say talk about equanimity, but how come people have equanimity in the face of being attacked? It feels like an attack. But I do notice that when I feel attacked in the moment and then I reflect on it later, then I do learn something from what they've said, usually.
That's the practice, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd like not to be attacked, not to be upset in the moment, though.
Sure, yeah.
So the practice is getting faster at not being upset, like you recover quickly, more quickly.
So you mentioned that you want your students to respect you.
Yeah.
So when somebody comes and criticizes your teaching, you can gain their respect by saying, oh, please tell me more. I'd like to know more about what you're saying. Then they respect you.
I don't know many people who can do that. I've not witnessed that. I mean, I've seen, you know, I've met a lot of Buddhist teachers who have a lot of practice, and if you criticize them, they get upset. But I just, it's very rare to someone to go and just smile at you and go, tell me more, I want more. No, that's rare. Yeah. I guess that's the ideal.
You know, maybe it's rare right now in this culture, this society, but if you look at the Zen stories, the Zen literature, there are examples of that throughout. Some very inspiring stories. My favorite one, of course, is the one where Hakuin says, is that so?
Oh, all right, yeah.
Disrespected, accused, criticized, beat down, beat up. Is that so?
Yeah, that's a good story.
I love that story. Mm-hmm. So we all have a koan. You've just spoken about one. We all have koans like that. Thank you.
Thanks, Les.
Yeah.
There's monuments going all through history. I guess the Egyptian pyramids, the Sphinx, yeah. And they can be powerful. I remember it was probably 2003, 2004, when during the Iraq invasion, they toppled the statue of Saddam Hussein, and it was tall. It was maybe 20, 30 feet tall. And the people were hitting it with their shoes. It was fascinating to see how much emotion came from toppling a statue, a symbol. And of course they played it over and over on a loop. And now we're experiencing something similar here with the monuments in the South, the Confederacy, the display of Ten Commandments on public grounds, or, you know, just social issues like that. And is the creation of a monument in itself the problem, or is it the emphasis, the taking it too literally? I probably have my own monuments, you know, of ego attachment. I'm a contractor, so I can be proud about that. Or you know, I guess my question is having a monument itself the creation of it the problem, or is it our attitude toward it? Thank you.
No, you're right. It's our attitude, not the creation itself. You know, if we establish a monument and we sincerely believe that this is a gift for everyone, not just for myself or not just for a small group, but this is for everyone to admire and to be inspired by. But if the monument has, you know, limitations that only these people will appreciate it and these others will not like it, this is a difficult monument. And someday people will tear it down. But there are monuments that appeal to everyone, like the Notre Dame Cathedral. Nobody is objecting to the repair of that monument. Everybody, whether they are French or not, whether they are Catholic or not, everybody says, yes, rebuild it, we love it. Because it is seen as a gift to everyone without restriction. Sometimes we can be confused by our motivation, though. Thank you.
Les, what you said about monuments, and in particular Richard's question and your answer reminds me of something that I experienced a couple of weeks ago. In fact, you may have noticed in that wonderful birthday video that Bonnie put together that my little snippet, I was standing in front of a building in Norway. It was this wonderful wooden structure called a stave church. It's very, very old, about 1,200 years old. And there are still a couple dozen of these things that exist around Norway. They're very, very beautiful wooden buildings. This wonderful architecture with wooden rafters and dragons poking out the end and all this wonderful stuff. And I'd seen pictures of these. And generally, the pictures sort of emphasize the beautiful glow of the wood. And they're really marvelous buildings. And it's wonderful to see a wood building that's lasted for 1,200 years. But when we went to visit this, I noticed that except for the very top of the building, that wonderful wooden glow was missing. The building was this very dark, drab, sort of blackish, grayish brown. And except for the very top of it. And so I went over to a young woman who was sort of a docent there, and I said, well, what's the story with that? And she said, oh, well, they just haven't quite gotten to the top of the building yet. They've been working on redoing the preservative on the building. And they'll finish by doing the top. So I realized that all these beautiful pictures where the beautiful stave churches were this wonderful glowing wood, that's very unusual because most of the time they're covered with this, it's basically creosote. It smells like an old telephone pole. And so what they've done, I mean, you can't really criticize them for keeping this thing intact for 1,200 years, a wooden building that's lasted for 12 centuries. But on the other hand, there's a real trade-off there because this thing that originally was alive and beautiful and glowing is now all smelly and covered with this dark brown stuff, and they have to keep back, coming back and coating it with this stuff all the time. And I think it kind of relates to what you were saying about how monuments, you know, they took this thing and they made it into a monument, and it's all sort of encrusted now. And you have to kind of squint at it real hard to even see the beautiful thing that it really was when it was first built. So, I mean, your statement about how maybe when something is built, it isn't necessarily an old crusty monument, but we can make it into one if we really decide to. I think that's what happened at these stave churches. It's wonderful to see them, but they sure look funny and they smell bad.
What, say the name again, state?
Stave. Like a barrel stave.
Oh, stave?
Stave. Stave church.
What does that mean? Do you know? Stave?
Well, I think it just has to do with the way that the wood was shaped and put together in constructing the church. It's not a particular religion or anything. In fact, I think these date back to pre-Christian times, actually. But, yeah, they're very beautiful, but not so much when they're covered with creosote and smelling bad.
When you were there, did you hear anything? Was there any talk about, why don't we let them go? Why do we keep fixing them up? They're too much trouble, they're too old. Why don't we just get rid of them?
No, they're very attached to their stave churches. They will never, just in order to enjoy them in their full beauty for a while. Every once in a while, just before they put the next layer of creosote on, they look really good. And then wham, on goes the smelly, stinky, dark brown stuff.
Okay. Thank you.
Quick question, Les. We're talking about what you said was really interesting. We human beings are interesting creatures because what we do is we try to keep our memories alive by creating these monuments, and then nothing else but a reminder of the past. It's like, you know, somebody comes by and says, why won't you let the past die? You know, it's like, we just want to keep on. And this is how Was thinking about the Lewis Gates Jr. program that's on KQED about he goes and finds the ancestry of the people, and that book sort of becomes a monument to their family. And these are all things that we as human beings do. And there is some kind of need in us to have this kind of reminder where we came from. There's some, the Aborigines, when they kill the animal in the desert, they will leave a monument as a form of reverence, saying that this animal gave its life to feed us. So there is something instinctual or desire to have these monuments in all of us. This is what was coming up to me.
I have a clarificatory question. Early in the talk, you seem to have drawn a distinction between performing benevolent actions for the sake of your own happiness and performing benevolent actions for the sake of everybody else's happiness or the object of the person who you're performing benevolent actions towards. And if you perform benevolent actions for the sake of yourself, for your sake of your own happiness, you run the risk of creating these monuments, if I understood you correctly. Now, if I also understood you correctly, Zen practice is supposed to change your motivation from performing actions for the sake of your own happiness to performing actions for the sake of the object of your benevolence. Is that correct?
Zen practice doesn't create change. Okay. Your own motivation creates the change.
Okay. So are you? Yeah.
So we have to be mindful about how we talk about such things. To say Zen practice changes me, no. Me changes me. You change you. So the vehicle is the practice.
Okay.
You know.
And the vehicle being the practice, does our motivation through this vehicle, are we expected to change our motivation all at once?
Expected?
If we want to develop ourself and find ourselves and find our authentic self, or develop in a way that is more authentic or towards enlightenment, are we expected to change our motivation all at once? Or is it a gradual process?
If you are seeking a benefit, you become discouraged. Just practice and forget such questions. Just practice. Try to trust what you're doing. And don't get involved in metaphysical concerns about sooner or later or what's expected. Just practice, join everybody else. Here we are doing this together. That's all, it's very simple. So you do the practice and there are no promises.
I'll just make a quick comment.
Okay.
Because when we were talking about monuments, there's one in particular that stood out to me. It was my first time in New York City, and my friends were driving around trying to show me all the big flashy things, and they said, "And this is the Christopher Columbus." And I was like, "I want to replace him with Pocahontas." You know? And I thought, "Why is that?" And we talked about tearing down monuments, and it's the changing consciousness. So 50 years back, probably it was very common to just celebrate Thanksgiving and think of it as this very positive thing. And now we have this growing awareness of that the Native Americans were displaced and they were starved and they were infected and they were brutalized and raped. And now it leaves like this this bad taste in our mouth to think about Thanksgiving and the pilgrimage and like how they were extended a warm hand and rather than thanking them, they exploited them. So, and I think most monuments as well as history books are that way. It's written by and built by whoever won. And the side who won it, the other side is forgotten. And then it occurred to me, well, when will this stop happening? It's only going to be when there is no this side versus that side. So the point that made the most difference in your talk for me was when it's built for everyone, when everyone can enjoy it, that's how you know it's really adding value that lasts. And that I think that is a good just guidepost. Like, and what is what I'm doing of lasting value? Well, is it of service to everyone? So I think that really helped me.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N. D-O dot O-R-G.